Blog Talk Radio.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. More than 100,000 children in Ethiopia's Tigray region face life-threatening severe acute malnutrition in the next year, a tenfold jump over average annual levels. The warning on Friday from UN Children's Fund UNICEF that comes after the agency managed to reach previously inaccessible areas in the northern region where conflict nears its ninth month. Spokesperson Marixi Mercado told a UN briefing in Geneva that aid workers' worst fears about the health and well-being of children have been confirmed.
We need unfettered access into Tigray and across the region in order to provide support to children that children and women urgently need. Right now, we have just 6,900 cartons of life-saving, ready-to-eat therapeutic foods in our warehouses in Tigray. That is enough to treat severe malnutrition in just 6,900 children.
Ms. Mercado said that 47% of pregnant and breastfeeding women were acutely malnourished. This increases their risk of encountering more pregnancy-related complications and of maternal death during childbirth, she said, along with the delivery of low birth weight babies. To Libya, where rights experts have appealed to the authorities to rid the country of mercenaries for the sake of successful national elections in December. The appeal comes 9 months since a UN-led ceasefire agreement, which specifically called for the withdrawal of foreign forces from the oil-rich state. According to the UN Working Group on Mercenaries, well-trained and well-armed private contractors have come from Russia, Syria, Sudan and Chad and continue to operate in Libya. They should all leave and there must be an immediate end to the transfer of military weapons and materials into Libya, the experts insisted, while also warning that the presence of mercenaries could also affect regional security and stability. The development follows a warning last year by the same UN panel that Libya's reliance on mercenaries and related actors since 2019 had contributed to the escalation of conflict and undermined the peace process. Support for mercenary activity in Libya was a breach of the existing arms embargo imposed by the UN Security Council, the UN Working Group said. There must be real accountability for abuses committed by mercenaries, mercenary-related actors and private contractors, said the experts. A rise in hate crimes and attacks against Roma people on social media must be reversed immediately, the UN-appointed independent rights expert said on Friday. In a warning that the global Romani community is facing the same divisive rhetoric as faced by the Jews in Nazi Germany, UN Special Rapporteur Fernand de Varenne's urged countries to act against the practice. It's tragic that almost 80 years after the Romani genocide during World War II, minorities, particularly Roma in Europe, are increasingly experiencing hate speech and are being targeted by politicians and others, he said. Among his recommendations, the right expert urged greater public education about Romani Holocaust, along with measures to address the exclusion and discrimination faced by Roma today. Roma Holocaust Memorial Day on 2nd of August marks the night in 1944 when some 3,000 Roma of all ages from Auschwitz-Birkenau camp were murdered in the gas chambers. The date also commemorates the victims of the Romani genocide by Nazi Germany and its allies. It's believed that between 25 and 50% of Europe's 1 to 1.5 million Roma were likely exterminated. Katie Dartford, UN News.
Hello. In today's show, a global deal to help get rid of plastic waste, a call for a COVID ceasefire in Myanmar, how more efficient food production could help solve a global hunger crisis, and positive coronavirus vaccine developments in Africa. All this and more in this week's UN Catch-Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson, and Solange Berhetegui-Cortez. Thanks for listening. Let's start with the news. Here's Katie Dartford.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Inefficient global food production is at the root of a huge rise in hunger and one-third of all emissions, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has warned in a call to transform food systems for sustainable development. Up to 118 million people faced hunger in 2020, as many as 161 million more than in 2019, Mr. Guterres said at the preparation meeting for the UN Food Systems Summit in Rome beginning Monday. Pointing to the disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the UN chief added that 3 billion people cannot afford to eat healthily either. Echoing those concerns and urging action, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed welcomed the fact that 145 countries had approached youth, farmers, indigenous peoples and others for sustainable ideas ahead of September's food summit in New York.
We must work country by country, region by region, community by community, to ensure the diversity of needs are addressed to support each reality. The same applies for our food systems and the changes that are required so that we feed the world without starving the planet of its future.
Some good news from Africa now, where COVID-19 vaccine shipments have ramped up after a near halt to deliveries in recent months. According to the World Health Organization, nearly 4 million doses of coronavirus vaccines from the UN-partnered COVAX initiative arrived in Africa last week, compared with just 245,000 for all of June. In total, almost 79 million COVID-19 vaccine doses have reached Africa and 21 million people, or just 1.6% of Africa's population, are fully vaccinated. Staying with the coronavirus, and COVID-19 infections rose 8% last week to more than 3.8 million, and the number of new deaths increased in all regions apart from Europe, according to the WHO. Latest data from the UN Health Agency pointed to a substantial uptick in infections in the Americas and the Western Pacific, or the four COVID-19 mutations that the WHO's designated variants of concern. The Alpha variant is now present in 182 countries, the Beta strain in 131, Gamma in 81, and the Delta variant is in 132 countries. The UN independent expert on Myanmar has called for a COVID ceasefire on healthcare workers as infections and deaths soar. The special rapporteur Tom Andrews alleged on Tuesday that junta forces had committed 260 attacks against medical personnel and facilities, causing at least 18 deaths. Meanwhile, more than 600 healthcare professionals are eluding arrest warrants, and at least 67 have been detained, Ms. Andrews said in a statement. Katie Dartford, UN News.
The headlines there, and this is UN Catch Up Dateline Geneva with me, Daniel Johnson. Now to this week's interview, which was inspired by a photo exhibition on the shores of beautiful Lake Geneva on a not-so-beautiful topic, plastic waste. The images on display show just how invasive this trash has become. It is everywhere, but that could be a thing of the past thanks to the Basel Convention and a new legally binding international pact by 180 countries to process their plastic waste more sustainably than ever before. For more on this, I spoke to photo competition finalist Sienna Goldstein and first Rolf Paye, head of the Basel Convention, which organised the Plastic is Forever exhibition. Here he is explaining what the new plastic waste deal means in practice.
What the agreement means for those countries is that countries cannot just ship any type of plastic that they want to. They cannot mix it with anything else. And also they have to declare it, which means that it has to go through what we call a prior informed consent, which means if country A is sending plastic waste to country B, it has to notify this country of the shipment, what kind of plastic and the state of the plastic, and also have the assurance from country B that this country has the ability to recycle or manage this plastic in a sound environmental manner and not really throw it in the landfill or throw it in the ocean. Overall, as you can see, we've kind of made the system more transparent and more visible, and as a result, reduced the amount of plastic that goes into the ocean.
Thank you, Rolf. Now, you're speaking to me from the Seychelles, which is where a photo by Sienna Goldstein was also taken for this exhibition. It shows a gorgeous beach at sunset where there's lots of plastic litter. Sienna, hi. Why did you choose this photo?
Well, I think it really highlights how rubbish can spoil a scene, especially one that's so beautiful, full of nature, and especially in such a small like island where we're just surrounded by nature constantly. It really shows how we are impacted by plastic waste, and I wanted to raise awareness about that, especially when a lot of people don't see it happening.
You say people don't see it happening. I mean, presumably it's just cleared up this waste, but then the same littering happens again. Obviously, it's a terrible shame, but do you think you're representative of your friends? How old are you, Sienna?
I'm 15, just recently.
And do your friends feel as cross as you do about seeing this plastic waste all over the place?
Yes, definitely. We usually actually do beach cleanups a lot and sometimes when we're going out and we take a plastic bag with us to the beach and pick stuff up, because it's really, really horrible seeing an environment that once, like when we were younger, you didn't really see as much plastic waste. And it's quite sad, actually, to see that this could be our future.
Do you think that this plastic waste amendment agreement is going to have a real impact on the state of your beaches in the beautiful Seychelles?
I think so, but the only problem with Seychelles is we don't really have a huge recycling system. It's not, or at least it's not known by many. So I think we first need to work on developing a recycling system and educating people on how to recycle, setting up bins with the different sections around the Seychelles, and then we can see some impact.
Rolf, I'm going to turn to you quickly. Is that music to your ears to hear somebody so energized and passionate about cleaning up the planet?
No, it's not. I mean, I share the same view. I mean, the same concern as well. In fact, Seychelles is a small island, and with recycling, you need to have a certain level of economies of scale. And that is why the Basel Convention allows the transboundary movement of these types of waste. What Seychelles needs to do is to sort the plastic waste out, package them, compress them, and send it to a proper recycling center either in the region and elsewhere. Now, they do have arrangements, as far as I know, the government officials and the companies operating here do have arrangements for sending those waste. And of course, at the national level, I think there needs to be tougher measures for encouraging people to recycle, separate their plastic waste so that the recyclers themselves can have this economies of scale, you know. So it's really on the consumer end and the household end that I think a lot of work needs to be done.
Back to you, Sienna, quickly. Did you know that the United States hasn't signed this plastic waste amendment? What do you think it's going to take for other countries and big polluters to sign? How are you going to convince them? If you had a message to them, what would you say?
Well, I think that especially since the United States, they produce so much rubbish and so much products for the rest of the world, then maybe we need to do some sort of protest or petition to show them how we feel about it. Because only when you feel the pressure on you, I think you will start to change and see what you're doing wrong. So maybe all the other countries need to come together and say, well, you are producing all these plastics. You brought it to our countries. You have to do this also.
Now, we've spoken about your photograph, but have you seen any other photographs from the exhibition on plastic waste that's been taking place in Geneva? Have you seen any other photos in this exhibition that have really hit home with you just how bad the plastic waste problem is?
Yes, me and my mom looked at the exhibition, and it really amazed me because I live in a small island. But I did grow up in South Africa, so I did see rubbish all around me a lot. Not as much, though, as I've seen in, like, Indonesia, in Ghana, in Bangladesh. I saw those photos and it really shocked me.
And Rolf, I wonder quickly, finally, to you if we're not approaching this with enough urgency. I was talking to the UN's disaster relief chief the other day, and she was saying that this is the kind of problem that politicians don't really want to get involved with because it's a long-term sort of problem. Isn't plastic the same? I mean, how do you change the mentality about it being a really urgent problem that we should fix?
Okay, as you know, politicians are already focusing on development issues. And when it comes to the plastics issue, it fits within the Sustainable Development Agenda, the 2030 Agenda. And for me, the time is now. We need to act now, and there is political will now, and I think we will come out with something even more stronger in the next few years.
Rolf Payet from the Basel Convention with insight on what the international community is doing to stop so much plastic going into landfills and the sea. And of course the inspiring Sienna Goldstein before him on what she and her friends are doing to help keep beaches plastic free. Thanks to them both. Now let me turn to the show's regular guest, Solange Berhetegui-Cortez, for some closing thoughts. I should say, Solange, that you're joining us even though you're on holiday. Now that's what I call commitment. Listening to Rolf and Sienna talk about the planet's plastic crisis from a very different angle just now, I wonder, what's your take?
Hola, Daniel. Well, because of COVID, I'm staying in Geneva, exploring Switzerland and catching up on some reading. And at the beginning of T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland, the poet asks, what are the roots that clutch? What branches grow out of this stony rubbish? Literature is full of waste, you know. The process of writing makes this unavoidable. just look at any handwritten transcript. I saw the exhibition in Geneva. I found the title, Plastic is Forever, disturbing. Plastic never fully disappears. It takes between 20 and 500 years for plastic to break up into tiny pieces, microplastics. The 21 photographs of the exhibition gives us a powerful insight of plastic waste in different countries and continents. They are a testimony that many of these tiny plastic particles are swallowed by farm animals or fish who mistake them for food, which then find their way onto our dinner plates. And listen, Daniel, it has been estimated that humans ingest a credit card worth of plastic per week. Do your own calculations. You're going to be surprised. At this rate, we will become plastic ourselves. While we consider this a natural situation, on the other side of the fence, as always, there are the most vulnerable, the poor, swimming in plastic rivers, trying to survive. What does this tell us about our civilization? It cannot be simple, negative material. I saw Sienna's picture representing how plastic can be found even in the most serene places and overshadow the beauty of a sunrise. And then there was a photo from Paula Porrovija entitled Plastic Sunset. It shows the sunset seen through the hole of a plastic bag on a beach in Croatia. The beauty of her composition made me more certain than ever that plastic is not the problem per se, rather, the way we deal with it. The real issue is the management and effects of waste. Waste did not simply arrive in modern times. Plastic does not miraculously appear in rivers and oceans. There is always an explanation, a reason, a responsibility, and in that sense, the Basel Convention Plastic Waste Deal is excellent news. With 180 countries on board, no country will be treated anymore like a rubbish dump. I don't know what waste actually does in T.S. Eliot's poem, but I know we do not want to leave and leave to future generations a wasteland.
Thank you, Solange. I echo that. I'm sure anybody, any right-thinking person would do that. And as you say, also, it's a case of managing this waste. It's not the plastic which is necessarily the problem. And over the past year, medical teams all around the world have needed their hospital gowns, gloves, masks, sanitizer bottles to deal with the COVID-19 pandemic, which has, of course, driven the production of single-use plastics to skyrocket. Please go back to your holiday. Listeners, let's let it go now. Drop us a line at the UN Geneva Facebook page, Twitter, or Instagram. We hope you enjoyed the show and can join us next time. Bye-bye for now.
Thank you, Daniel. See you next week. Hasta pronto.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres on Thursday urged states to take action against human trafficking, in which one third of victims are children, highlighting how the COVID pandemic has pushed as many as 124 million more people into extreme poverty. The UN chief insisted that many millions have been left vulnerable to trafficking. Half of those trafficked in low-income countries are children, and most are trafficked for forced labour. Criminals everywhere are using technology to identify, control and exploit vulnerable people, the UN Secretary General said, adding that youngsters are increasingly targeted through online platforms for sexual exploitation, forced marriage and other forms of abuse. Almost a year since the portside explosions that devastated Beirut, UN organisation UNESCO has renewed its call for international solidarity to help the people of the Lebanese capital recover. The blasts on the 4th of August 2020 damaged more than 270 schools, training centres and university campuses, affecting at least 85,000 students. In a statement on Thursday, UNESCO announced that it's working to repair over 130 educational facilities, with 85 schools already finished and teaching equipment provided to 25 others. The UN Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization has also implemented a training program for teachers and school leaders affected by the blasts to equip them with new skills such as providing quality distance learning. UNESCO's International Restoration Initiative for the Lebanese capital, Li Beirut, places education, culture and heritage at the heart of reconstruction efforts. In addition to repairs to schools and universities, the UN body has received support from member states, Germany and Italy, to stabilize severely damaged heritage buildings, such as the Sursok Museum. Some good news from Africa now, where COVID-19 vaccine shipments have ramped up after a near halt to deliveries in recent months. According to the World Health Organization, nearly 4 million doses of coronavirus vaccines from the UN-partnered COVAX initiative arrived in Africa last week, compared with just 245,000 for all of June. The WHO said that it hoped COVAX would ship 520 million doses to Africa by the end of 2021, in addition to more shots from other sources. These include deliveries from the African Union, which is expected to supply around 45 million doses by the end of the year. In total, almost 79 million COVID-19 vaccine doses have reached Africa, and 21 million people, or just 1.6% of Africa's population, are fully vaccinated. Katie Dartford, UN News.
I'm Deanne Penn with UN News. 6 months since the military coup in Myanmar, the UN and partners are doing their utmost to help protect the country's people and show solidarity with their plight, amid mass displacement linked to deadly clashes with government forces and the ongoing COVID-19 crisis. That's the message from the organization's top acting humanitarian coordinator in the country, Ramanathan Balakrishnan, who's been speaking to UN News' Daniel Johnson.
Well, it has been 6 months since the military seized control of the government in Myanmar, and Myanmar continues to be in a state of political, human rights and humanitarian crisis. In fact, the situation, if any, has only gotten worse. The situation in the country is characterized now by instability and a deteriorating socioeconomic and security situation. And to add to that, we have a raging third wave of COVID-19. So armed conflict between the Myanmar security forces and the ethnic armed organizations has intensified in several ethnic minority areas, including in the states of Shan, Chin, and Kachin. These hostilities have actually resulted in a displacement of more than 200,000 people. Also, we continue to see worryingly widespread use of lethal force, as well as series of violations of human rights by the security forces.
You've mentioned 200,000 people displaced in the 6 months since the coup. So your current assessment of humanitarian needs is what? It's a vast country, but how do you tackle that one? Where do you start?
Even before the coup started, the humanitarian canvas of Myanmar was quite large. According to the humanitarian response plan of 2021, in January, there were 1 million people, including internally displaced people in Rakhine State, in need of urgent humanitarian assistance. This number has only swelled. You know, following the coup, additional 2 million were identified as those in urgent need of humanitarian aid, and these were initially largely in the urban areas of Yangon, Mandalay, etc. However, since the intensification of clashes, we have had more number of internally displaced people, and also the worsening socioeconomic and the livelihood situation is all pushing, even as we speak, tens of thousands of people into the humanitarian space.
You've outlined the scale of the crisis. You've mentioned the socioeconomic problems, which are no doubt exacerbated by COVID. On a day-to-day level, what does this mean for people? Can they get enough to eat?
According to a WFP report, there is increasing risk of millions of people in Myanmar facing food security issues as we go further into the year. This has also been corroborated by a recent study, Food and Agricultural Organization. So what this has meant is that there has been, since the coup, there has been increase in the prices of basic commodities for many people. And this has also resulted in a reduction in the nutrition value of the food basket that people usually take as they substitute the regular food with cheaper and more readily available food items. On the health system has been severely compromised since the military coup. And this has meant disruption in basic health services to millions of people across the country. This has only worsened further the impact of the COVID-19, the third wave that the country is currently reeling under. In addition to that, children have been out of school for more than a year on account of COVID-19, and more recently, school teachers and professionals participating in the civil disobedience movement.
And staying with children, we have heard reports, we know they've been wounded and killed. How are you communicating the responsibility of all parties and particularly the authorities to protect them?
Killing of the children, you know, has been one of the saddest part and one of the most appalling part of the coup. To date, we know that at least 60 children have been killed, and many of them have been killed with live ammunition. They have been shot with live ammunition. And this is totally appalling, and it goes against the rights of the child. Not only the killing of the children, but there will also be arbitrary detention of children has also happened. And estimates indicate that among half the number of people detained are children and young people. UNICEF, one of the leading UN agencies on children, has time and again condemned in the strongest possible terms against the use of force against children, including the use of live ammunition and arbitrary detention of children, and has called on security forces to refrain from violence and to keep children and young people out of harm's way. So one thing which I would like to remind here is that Myanmar is bound to uphold all children's rights as enshrined in the Convention of the Rights of the Child, CRC, and also the Myanmar Child Rights Law, enacted in 2019.
Maybe we could just turn quickly to what the United Nations and partner organizations are doing concretely to support the people of Myanmar.
The main focus of the United Nations in Myanmar has been along two axes. A, to deliver humanitarian assistance and protection services to those in need, and to respond to the current wave of the COVID-19. In addition, the United Nations is continuing to work with people and communities to improve their livelihoods and build resilience and support access to justice to the extent possible by preserving the democratic space as well. Of course, since the military takeover, the United Nations in Myanmar has limited its engagement with the de facto authorities and is primarily focusing on humanitarian assistance and also implementing its program through non-state actors, including civil society organizations and the private sector.
Thank you. And you did mention COVID, the crisis, which has deteriorated rapidly in Myanmar. Do you know the level of current needs and what could the international community do to help?
To start with, I have to underline that the current outbreak of COVID-19 is expected to have devastating consequences for the health and population and for the economy in Myanmar. Over the past week alone, the daily positivity rate has reached as high as 40%. So access to hospital beds and oxygen is limited due to insufficient supplies and manpower. So there is an immediate need for scaling up of the provision of critical health services and COVID-19 vaccination efforts. The UN country team is working to address the oxygen shortage through the procurement of oxygen concentrators and other necessary equipment through multiple channels. In addition, efforts to accelerate COVID-19 vaccination, including its availability, is also underway. United Nations Agency, World Health Organization, is leading efforts to reoperationalize the testing, and COVID-19 treatment centers are being established with available resources and capacities.
Finally, what would your message be for the people of Myanmar? And you have mentioned that you're in contact with civil society, but what is it that you really want to tell them in terms of perhaps reassurance that you're still with them?
My message would be the UN in Myanmar continues to stand in solidarity with the people of Myanmar, respecting their will. The UN will continue to call out human rights violations and is committed to stay and deliver life-saving humanitarian assistance to the people of Myanmar, in addition to strengthening the COVID-19 response. One of the major problems that the UN is facing and its partners are facing is the access. This includes cumbersome travel authorization process, limited access to certain parts of country on account of the security issues, as well as the ongoing disruptions in the banking systems, limiting the ability to transfer funds to UN partners and thus delivering humanitarian assistance in a timely manner. But despite this, the UN has continued to deliver life-saving humanitarian assistance in Yangon, Mandalay, and also in Rakhine, and in many parts of the country. However, the response efforts are also constrained for Myanmar. The humanitarian response plan for Myanmar is currently funded at only 28-30% of its overall envelope of about $275 million. And this is one major area which needs to be addressed by donor governments as we are seeking desperately to increase the humanitarian assistance to the people of Myanmar.
This is the news in brief from the United Nations. COVID-19 infections rose 8% last week to more than 3.8 million, and the number of new deaths increased in all regions apart from Europe, according to the World Health Organization. Latest data from the UN Health Agency pointed to a substantial uptick in infections in the Americas and the Western Pacific, up 30% and 25% respectively. Regionally, Southeast Asia also reported a 3% increase in infections compared to the previous 7 days. Of the four COVID-19 mutations that the WHO's designated variants of concern, the Alpha variant is now present in 182 countries, the Beta strain in 131, Gamma in 81, and the Delta variant is in 132 countries. On the issue of vaccine effectiveness, the World Health Organization cited several laboratory studies showing that coronavirus transmission to household members was reduced by approximately half after at least one jab. The UN independent expert on Myanmar has called for a COVID ceasefire on healthcare workers as infections and deaths soar. Special Rapporteur Tom Andrews alleged on Tuesday that junta forces had committed 260 attacks against medical personnel and facilities, causing at least 18 deaths. Meanwhile, more than 600 healthcare professionals are eluding arrest warrants and at least 67 have been detained, Mr. Andrews said in a statement. Too many in Myanmar have needlessly perished and too many more will die without action by the United Nations, he warned, before urging the Security Council to demand that Myanmar's military rulers stop all attacks, particularly against healthcare professionals. Refugees have never needed more protection, top UN Refugee Agency official Filippo Grandi said on Wednesday, marking the 70th anniversary of the 1951 Refugee Convention. In appeal to all countries to recommit to the spirit and fundamental principles of the treaty, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees insisted that thanks to the convention, millions of lives have been saved. Mr. Grandi expressed alarm at recent attempts by unnamed governments to disregard or circumvent the convention's principles. This included expulsions and pushbacks of refugees and asylum seekers at land and sea borders and proposals to forcibly transfer them for processing to third states without proper protection safeguards. The language of the convention is clear as to the rights of refugees and remains applicable in the context of contemporary and unprecedented challenges and emergencies such as the COVID-19 pandemic, the UN Refugee Agency chief said. The 1951 Refugee Convention was born after 26 states met in Geneva to finalize the text of the treaty. The convention and the 1967 protocol, which broadened its scope, define who is a refugee and what protection, assistance and rights they have. Katie Dartford, UN News.
This is Matt Wells at UN News. Conflict in Afghanistan is worsening and increasingly pitting Afghans against Afghans as most international forces pull out of the country, with nearly 800 civilians killed and more than 1,600 wounded in May and June alone. This latest data from the UN Assistance Mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, reflects the highest casualty numbers over any two-month period since records began in 2009. In an interview with UN News' Daniel Johnson, UNAMA's head of human rights, Fiona Fraser, insists that what ordinary Afghans want is peace amid an ongoing assault by Taliban and other non-state armed groups.
So civilian casualties in Afghanistan were among the highest levels on record in the first half of 2021. UNAMA documented in its Protection of Civilians in Armed Conflict mid-year update over 5,000 civilian casualties, which is a 47% increase compared with the same period in 2020. What's of particular concern is that since early May, when international military forces began to withdraw, the fighting intensified following the Taliban's offensive UNAMA documented a sharp increase in killings and injuries of Afghans. And what we're seeing is a conflict that is much more now about Afghans fighting Afghans.
The statistics are awful and they're much worse than last year. What does it actually mean on the ground for people? There are terrible reports of increased numbers of bombings and particularly children and women targeted.
We documented that for the first half of this year, we had record numbers of women and children killed, and they came to nearly half of all civilian casualties that we documented. And what this means in their lives is that when women and children are sheltering in their homes, many of them are killed and injured from mortars, artillery, as well as airstrikes, and they also suffered harm from IED. There was a particular egregious attack outside a school in Kabul on the 8th of May, and it killed and injured over 300 civilians. Many of them were schoolgirls as they were leaving the school to go home. That attack was unclaimed. We've also seen in the past 6 months a rise in a number of deliberate sectarian motivated attacks against the Shia Muslim religious minority, and in particular the Hazara community. Such attacks were nearly all claimed actually by ISIL-KP. And just to give you a sense, in May and June alone, we documented 8 IEDs that targeted buses carrying members of the Hazara community.
So based on what you've just been telling me, it's really not a black and white picture. It's not just the Taliban. It's ISIL, as you say. We have casualties among civilians from government troops as well. So what is UNAMA's role? What can you do to help civilians under increasing pressure who are fleeing the south and they're fleeing the north, we hear?
UNAMA's role in documenting, particularly the Human Rights Service, in documenting the harm caused to civilians by the conflict is that we have then a record by an independent entity such as the UN, and then we have a record of the harm caused. We also raise with the parties to the conflict what tactics have resulted in civilian harm, then go to them urging them to do their utmost to mitigate harm to civilians, to do their utmost to protect civilians. And what this report is really saying is that unless there is a significant de-escalation in violence, our projections are that more Afghan civilians will be killed and injured this year than we have ever recorded. And so our role is going to the parties to say to them they need to step back, they need to look to establish a ceasefire, they need to focus on the negotiation table and not on the battlefield, and really need to do their utmost to protect civilians from harm. And civilians, we're talking about Afghans.
Yes, and you say in your latest report that the conflict is likely to become more deadly as fighting draws closer to urban areas. So what is your message for the international community?
The issue is that the parties do need to step back and they need to declare a ceasefire and look to do more to protect civilians. Also, the international communities, including the regional, the countries from the region, the neighbourhood, you know, we urge them to do their utmost to influence the parties of the conflict, to urge them to declare a ceasefire and to return to the negotiation table. That is what we need to see, a return to the negotiation table, a ceasefire, and all the international community more broadly doing its utmost to influence the parties to protect civilians.
Can you confirm reports from the north that in places like Kunduz, the hospitals are overwhelmed by casualties from conflict, which is ongoing? Presumably, you do have some leverage with opposition fighters who have children who need healthcare.
Well, we work with the parties to the conflict. We urge them to do their utmost to protect civilians. We tell them how their conduct in the hostilities has impacted and either by killing or injuring civilians, and obviously we're talking about men, women, boys and girls. So it's our role to urge them to protect civilians and to go back to the negotiation table and to establish a ceasefire.
Where do you start when you try to promote people's basic human rights about being able to go to work or be educated in safety and about how wrong it is to reportedly force unmarried women to wed Taliban fighters. How do you start with that sort of challenge?
So when we come across any particular claims that that is taking place, we look to establish the facts, and we would go then to the parties or where there have been shifts in territorial control. We are looking to identify what is actually happening on the ground, what is the impact on individuals in their activities. And then we would go to the party who's in control and urge them that the treatment of individuals, and also we need to remember that whatever government may be in place, Afghanistan has signed up to an array of human rights obligations, and they don't come and go with the government. They are there because they've been ratified by Afghanistan.
And how is UNAMA's capacity functioning now, given that you've got the main pullout of international troops? What do you see the rest of the year panning out as?
As I said, when it comes to the issue of protection of civilians and civilian casualties, harm caused by the conflict, this report has outlined that unless there is a de-escalation in violence, we do predict from indications that we have that more Afghan civilians will be killed and injured this year than we have ever recorded. And hence, we need the parties to step back, establish a ceasefire, focus on the negotiation table and not on the battlefield.
I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how much more can the Afghan people take?
We know the Afghan people really, really want peace, and that's why we are urging the Taliban and Afghan leaders to do more to end the conflict, to protect their people, women, men, boys and girls, from further harm.
Fiona Fraser, we haven't had a chance to talk about accountability, which maybe should be the final question. You say that UNAMA's, which is the UN mission in Afghanistan, is recording the worst violations and civilian casualties. What's the next step?
We will continue to document civilian casualties, also violations of international human rights law. We will go to those who we see as being responsible. We will urge them to investigate and hold accountable perpetrators.
This is the News in Brief from the United Nations. 600 million students are still not in school across the world because of the COVID pandemic, UN Children's Fund UNICEF said on Tuesday. In an appeal to reopen schools as soon as possible, the UN agency warned that unless governments do so, students will face lasting harm. Remote learning is out of reach for at least a third of the world's school children, it said, before highlighting the case of Uganda, where classrooms have been shut for 306 days and where home internet connectivity is the lowest in the world at 0.3%. UNICEF noted that while governments face the impossible choice of locking down communities or else see COVID-19 infections skyrocket, there was clear evidence that primary and secondary schools were not among the main drivers of coronavirus transmission. By region, the UN agency said that nearly half the countries of Asia and the Pacific had closed their schools for more than 200 days during the pandemic. In Latin America and the Caribbean, which have seen some of the longest school closures, there are 18 countries and territories where schools are either closed or partially closed. In Eastern and Southern Africa, UNICEF said that 40% of all school-aged children are not in school today. To Tigray now, where there's growing concern for thousands of Eritrean refugees who remain trapped in camps there as fighting escalates in the region. UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR, said on Tuesday that an estimated 24,000 Eritrean refugees in Maieni and Adi Harush camps in western Tigray are cut off from humanitarian assistance and living in constant fear. Spokesperson Babar Balok said that 30 days of food supplies were delivered to the camps in June and that there was a real danger of hunger among the refugees if supplies do not resume.
Our staff have lost all access to these two refugee camps for the last 2 weeks. Trapped refugees need urgent, life-saving assistance. Clean drinking water is running out. No healthcare services are available, and hunger is a real danger. The last food distribution to both refugee camps was done in late June, which provided them rations for just 1 month.
UNHCR said that it had received credible reports that at least one refugee was killed by armed elements operating inside Maieni camp. This follows the killing of another refugee in the last 2 weeks, said UNHCR, which appealed to all warring parties to respect international humanitarian law and the right of all refugees and civilians to be protected from violence. A shipwreck off the Libyan coast has left dozens missing, feared dead, the UN Migration Agency IOM said on Tuesday. The UN agency said that the vessel was carrying at least 70 people when it left the Libyan port of Kunz late last Sunday. Spokesperson Paul Dillon said that the boat ran into trouble, took on water and sank. Local fishermen and the Libyan Coast Guard rescued 18 people, he said.
Survivors told our staff, who regularly respond to these heart-wrenching scenes, that at least 57 people are missing, among them at least 20 women and 2 toddlers.
The survivors, who are from Nigeria, Ghana and the Gambia, have received emergency medical assistance, food, water and comfort. This latest tragedy pushes the 2021 death toll on the central Mediterranean route to roughly 970 men, women and children, IOM said, in a call for better migration management and greater solidarity from European Union countries. Daniel Johnson, UN News. This is the news in brief from the United Nations. Inefficient global food production is at the root of a huge rise in hunger and one-third of all emissions, UN Secretary-General Antonio Guterres has warned in a call to transform food systems for sustainable development. Up to 811 million people faced hunger in 2020, as many as 161 million more than in 2019, Mr. Guterres said at the preparation meeting for the UN Food Systems Summit in Rome beginning Monday. Pointing to the disruption caused by the COVID-19 pandemic, the UN chief added that 3 billion people cannot afford to eat healthily either. Echoing those concerns and urging action, UN Deputy Secretary General Amina Mohammed welcomed the fact that 145 countries had approached youth, farmers, indigenous peoples and others for sustainability ideas ahead of September's food summit in New York.
There is no one size that fits all. We must work country by country, region by region, community by community, to ensure the diversity of needs are addressed to support each reality. The same applies for our food systems and the changes that are required so that we feed the world without starving the planet of its future.
Ms. Mohammed highlighted that the pandemic had reversed efforts towards sustainable development, with latest UN data indicating that around 100 million people have been pushed into poverty since the start of the global health crisis. Nearly 200 nations started online climate negotiations on Monday to validate a UN-led report that will guide international efforts later this year to prevent climate catastrophe. The aim of this week's meeting of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, is to approve its report on the physical science behind climate change line by line. Once the final report is agreed by member states, it will provide the most up-to-date information on how our world is responding to increasing emissions. It is also expected to provide a better understanding of extreme weather and its link to climate change. More women and children were killed and wounded in Afghanistan in the first half of 2021 than in any comparable period since records began in 2009, a UN report showed on Monday. A particularly sharp rise in casualties took place in May, when international military forces began withdrawing from the country and fighting intensified following the Taliban's offensive. The UN mission in Afghanistan, UNAMA, reported in its mid-year update for 2021 that there was a 47% increase in civilian casualties compared with the same period last year. Deborah Lyons, the UN Secretary-General's Special Representative for Afghanistan, said that the data provided a clear warning that unprecedented numbers of Afghan civilians will perish and be maimed this year if the increasing violence is not stemmed. Daniel Johnson, UN News.